senior advisor at Global Witness. You can find their work online at globalwitness.org. Thank you so much, John Lloyd, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me. Cheers.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
If you're able, please go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution in support of the critical work of community radio. Thank you.
Every single person since SB 8 has been a law has needed to travel out of state. Every single person that's reached our line.
We've been clinging on to Roe versus Wade and the protection that it offered. And it feels as though that protection is being taken away from us. So it feels as though this is a moment of survival. And I think any moments of survival can be very scary.
What did abortion access look like in America when Roe was the law of the land? Tune into KBOO's Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast where I investigate this question as I take you through the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned Roe. That's Roe on the Rocks, airing Thursdays at 9 a.m. You don't want to miss it.
This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender, justice, and more. I'm your host, Sona Ali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll open our program with Matt Gertz. He is Senior Fellow at Media Matters for America. Matt has been doing extensive coverage of the recent FBI raid of former President Donald Trump's Florida residence at his Mar-a-Lago resort. Matt will analyze how Fox News has been covering the story and how the GOP is echoing the dangerously unhinged talking points. Then we'll turn to acclaimed comedian and award-winning TV host and producer W. Kamau Bell about a new book that he has just co-authored with Kate Schatz. It's called Do the Work, an Anti-Racist Activity Book, which Bell recommends as a great starting point for those who became newly politicized during the 2020 racial justice uprising but didn't know where to start. Finally, in the wake of pioneering Black actress Nichelle Nichols' death, We'll turn to political prisoner and award-winning journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal for a commentary for Prison Radio, where he'll explore Nichols's legacy. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The recent raid by the Federal Bureau of Investigation at Donald Trump's residence in his Mar-a-Lago, Florida resort has pro-Trump forces up in arms. Even though it appears that Trump illegally took boxes of sensitive documents into his custody, the fact that federal law enforcement, for the first time ever, raided a former president is enough to generate far-fetched accusations and conspiracy theories from the right. We turn now to Matt Gaetz. He is the senior fellow at Media Matters for America. He's been doing in-depth coverage of the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago and how Fox News in particular has been covering it. Among his latest stories is one titled, Fox is Paying Lara Trump to Lie About the Mar-a-Lago Search. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Thanks for having me back.
We'll get into the Lara Trump story, but first, for people who have not been paying very close attention, maybe they've seen some things that the New York Times is writing, maybe they've seen some things that Fox is posting about, there are some very basic facts in the story, right? One of them is that Trump is under investigation for illegally taking out of the White House and out of the custody of the National Archives a whole bunch of documentation, presidential documentation, right? That shouldn't be really in question, right?
Yeah, that's the basic backstory. I mean, it's important to remember that a president's documents are not his. They are the public's. They are owned by the federal government and through it, all of us. When a president leaves office, he's supposed to, or she is supposed to, leave behind all documentation of their presidency. That's been in effect since the 1970s in the wake of Richard Nixon leaving the White House. And so there's not really a question that he's not supposed to be in possession of documents from his presidency. Nonetheless, he seems to have taken a large number of documents, and the federal government has spent the last 15 months trying to get them back since the National Archives realized that it had been missing some prominent documents back in May of last year. So earlier this year, the National Archives, after a long negotiation, got a hold of 15 boxes of documents that Trump had taken to Mar-a-Lago, his residence in Florida, which is also a resort. Upon reviewing those documents, they determined that many of them contained classified information, making what was already a scandal somewhat worse. And then it turns out that those were not the end of the trove of documents that Trump had taken. Most recently, the FBI served a search warrant at his Mar-a-Lago estate last Monday. We found out on last Friday that there were 11 sets of documents that they had seized that included classified information. One of those sets was classified at the top secret TSI level, which is used to denote documents that include intelligence products. And several other sets were also classified top secret, confidential. And so there really is a large trove of documents that were being kept in the former president's Florida resort. He's not supposed to have them. Some of them seem to be classified and marked as such. And that's the sort of the base level of information.
One of the approaches that the right-wing media, in particular Fox News, seems to be taking to criticize the raid is that proper procedure wasn't followed, that there should have been a subpoena, there should have been this and that. Well, it turns out, well, first of all, whenever the Federal Bureau of Investigation does this sort of investigation, it isn't really supposed to go around advertising what it's doing. It tends to do its work fairly covertly for a good reason, and then eventually details may emerge. And now it's turning out, as details are emerging, that they did in fact do all of the things that Fox News is sort of accusing them of not doing, right? I mean, it seems as though it was conducted with all of the proper paperwork in place, if you will.
Yes, what we seem to have here is a escalating set of investigative procedures that are being rolled out as it becomes clear that former President Trump didn't want to cooperate. So first, it's the National Archives working with the Trump team on a voluntary basis to try to get them to give up the documents. Then there was a federal grand jury that issued a subpoena for documents back in the spring. And now we have a search being conducted of the property uncovering still more of these documents. And so, you know, the right-wing media, Fox News, and others are trying to claim that this is some sort of unnecessary and massive imposition on the former president, when what it really looks like is he and his people were not cooperating in returning the documents that they had and that they were not supposed to have. And this was the next step in the process to get them back.
I mean, it's incredible if you compare this reaction to the massive controversy that was created over Hillary Clinton's email servers and Hunter Biden's laptop. I mean, here we have a person who seems to have done much worse than what these others did, or, you know, it's arguable, not even as, not, you know, certainly you can argue that it is either on the same level as Hillary Clinton's email servers when she was Secretary of State, or much worse. And there are pretty clear double standards.
Yeah, I think when we talk about classified information and the Hillary Clinton email server, there was classified information on the server, but it was retroactively classified. It was information where, after the fact, the intelligence community went through all the emails and said, well, this fact is supposed to be classified, this fact is supposed to be classified. The Trump documents are not the same. These are documents where they are literally labeled with a stamp, top secret. It's very, very clear that that he is not supposed to be to have that information and be sort of waving it around. And so there is certainly a great deal of hypocrisy on the part of the right wing to suddenly try to turn the tables and say, oh no, everything here is fine.
So let's specifically hone in on Fox News's response. You wrote in Media Matters that Lara Trump, the former president's daughter-in-law, and her husband, who's of course Eric Trump, the president's son, are basically now being paid to defend their father on a media outlet? Tell me more.
So Fox News has hired any number of former Trump associates. I think I counted something like a dozen people who used to be in the Trump administration, were somehow part of the Trump orbit, and are now getting paychecks from the network. And Lara Trump is one of them. She was hired as a Fox News contributor last year, basically, I guess, as a way of having an inside person in the Trump family. You know, the way you could justify it is that, you know, she is getting information that no one else has about what is going on inside the Trump family, and therefore can provide that information to viewers. The more cynical and accurate way to look at it is that the network is paying someone to basically give the Trump party line and just putting money directly in the pockets of the Trump family to do it. And that seems to be what's happening here. You know, this story broke around 7 p.m. On last Monday night, you know, with Trump basically putting out the information saying he had been raided and it was a terrible thing. And Lara Trump was on Fox News about an hour later, which is about what you'd expect. And her commentary on this has been extraordinarily inaccurate. She's claimed at first that the former president is just sort of a lovable pack rat, that he takes lots of newspaper clippings and photographs and just, you know, collects stuff like that, and it's fine. But, you know, most newspaper clippings and photographs are not marked top secret. So that seems to have turned out to be inaccurate. She claimed that he was allowed to retain the documents, that he was just doing what other presidents are allowed to do. But in fact, all presidential documents are the public property and cannot be taken home by a former president. He claimed that the Trump team was cooperating. That's obviously not true. She referred to what the FBI had done. I found this very interesting. She described it as a bunch of people unannounced breaking into your home like this and taking whatever they want for themselves, which is basically positing that they're pulling a heist, right? That the FBI is breaking into the former president's house, they're sort of jimmying the door and sneaking about and stealing everything that isn't nailed down. That's obviously not what happened. There was a search warrant, given to the Trump team when the FBI arrived that very clearly said what they were looking for, which is documents that were being held by the former president in violation of three statutes. And that's, you know, what they ended up taking according to the itinerary, according to the receipt that, again, the Trump team received. She's also claimed that they didn't receive the search warrant. They didn't have the receipt. That's just not true. In fact, the Trump team gave it to Fox News on Friday when it was about to be unsealed. So, you know, there's just quite a deal of deceit going on here of Fox's viewers by someone who is theoretically being paid to give them some sort of special insight into what's happening inside the Trump family, when really she's just snowing them.
Matt, I'm also seeing another talking point, which is, what about Obama? And apparently this claim that is being bandied about, that Obama took millions of documents to Chicago when he left the White House, when it turns out that these were documents that were always in the custody of the National Archives and remain in their custody. So this also seems to be this other blatant lie.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty obvious one. It's called a presidential library. All of these former presidents have facilities that are maintained by the National Archives that include the records of their presidency. It's not a secret, it's not a scandal, it's literally just the way it works. These documents that were seized by the FBI were not in the custody of the National Archives. They were not in some sort of archival form where you know, relevant people could access them. They were in a storeroom off the pool. It's not really where you want to be storing your top secret documents, in a storeroom off the pool.
So the other aspect that has been pretty shocking in terms of Fox's response to the FBI raid is accusations aimed at the FBI that are now being echoed, I understand, you know, by the sort of usual pro-Trump rank and file, including GOP lawmakers, which has led to a spike in death threats aimed at the FBI and sort of violent threats aimed at FBI offices. I mean, one can have one's opinion about the FBI. The FBI has a sordid history against progressives and progressive leaders and activists throughout history. But in this particular case, it doesn't seem as though this is something that is that they're deserving of being targeted for, certainly not by violence.
Yeah, the rhetoric has really gotten out of hand, I think. And it did sort of all last week when the story was breaking. On Fox News, the FBI was being described as the East German Stasi, as the Nazi Gestapo. They were accused of planting evidence with no evidence of that happening at all. There were even claims that the FBI was planning former President Trump's assassination. It's really overheated and unhinged, and part of a broader effort by Fox News and others in the right-wing media to suggest to audiences that they should be personally very, very much afraid of this FBI raid, that the quote-unquote real target of this investigation is you, the viewer. And that, I think, is really riling up the right to an extent that we haven't seen since January 6th. And we all know what happened there, a violent mob that had been summoned to Washington, D.C. by the former president, ended up, storming the U.S. Capitol and, violently assaulting dozens of law enforcement officers as they tried to overturn the election. This kind of unhinged rhetoric can have some real and palpable danger to it. And I really think that Fox News should take a good hard look at what it's doing and consider the possibility that it's going to end up with an FBI body count.
It's interesting. Your organization, Media Matters, pointed out that Fox Business hosted a guest who blamed the FBI for sort of bringing it upon themselves. He literally said they actually asked for this. Terry Turchi was the guest, former deputy assistant director at the FBI. So, and of course, apparently a right-wing guest these days. And, this is coming from a part of the political spectrum that has traditionally supported law enforcement, right? And this, the same can be, that hypocrisy was revealed on January 6, 2021, too.
Yeah, I mean, at least theoretically, they like to talk a big game about how they support law enforcement when individual law enforcement officers are accused, often correctly, of brutality and violence, particularly against Black people and other people of color. But when it comes down to it, traditionally the right wing also is the low tax, low spend party. And so if you actually take a look at the budgets that President Trump was putting forward in his time at office, it was often engaged in a bit of defunding of the police. A lot of money that normally goes to law enforcement and security was actually being pulled in those budgets. So yes, there's a real, it's rhetoric over action when we talk about what the right is willing to do to defend law enforcement. And now they're just outright calling them the Gestapo.
And accusing them of planting evidence. I mean, if they were going to plant evidence, they wouldn't be openly doing raiding or they went in with a warrant. But apparently, this is the right sees this, or the pro-Trump right, as part of it has decided that maybe they were out there planting evidence, which also your organization, Media Matters, has covered. Matt, how does this raise the temperature in the nation? We have this landscape, political landscape, and cultural and social landscape, where armed conservatives who are pro-Trump are fed a lot of lies by Fox News. Those lies are often echoed by pro-Trump lawmakers, and they're angry, and they're armed, and it's terrifying for the rest of us.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the question is, what might someone do if they are deeply ensconced in this right-wing media bubble where that is the only source of information they get. And they trust these personalities to tell them the truth, and they take their views seriously. And they believe their claims that these federal agents are Nazis who are waging war on the American public and possibly trying to kill the former president and threatening their own safety and the safety of their families. What are we supposed to expect that they will do? I think most people will do nothing, that they will not carry this out, but there will be a fringe of people who will be given a target by this sort of rhetoric. And I think that's very scary.
Right. When Trump made very clear what he wanted his people to do ahead of January 6th, they did it. And we saw the January 6th House Select Committee's hearings revealing how literally they took the president. The other target has been Merrick Garland, the Justice Department head, who is being basically told very openly by Fox and by GOP lawmakers that he better get ready, that Trump's going to come and take the White House in 2024, and then the Justice Department will be in big trouble, and anyone who is loyal to him or the Biden administration is going to be in big trouble. And this feeds this myth, right, Matt, that Trump is being politically targeted because Democrats don't want him to run for president in 2024. But I mean, President Biden doesn't, I mean, these are FBI ongoing federal investigations that he doesn't directly control, right? That Biden doesn't control.
I mean, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, was nominated by former President Trump. Right. He's a Republican. The idea that he is engaged in some sort of conspiracy with the Biden administration to throw Trump in prison on nonsensical charges just doesn't hold up at all. But yes, he's receiving threats from Trump supporters. Merrick Garland is receiving threats. The magistrate judge in Florida who signed off on the warrant, the FBI agents who participated in the raid and are now being sort of identified by some on the right, they're all getting threats as well. The temperature is rising quite a bit, and we don't really know where it's going to end.
How are Republican lawmakers echoing Fox talking points? Does Fox give them cover? Or does the GOP give Fox cover? Or is it just this bizarre symbiosis?
I think symbiosis is the right way to think about it. I mean, they are all sort of in the same environment, right? They're all talking to each other, at each other, within that same right-wing bubble. And so members of Congress know that what they see on Fox News reflects the base is hearing, the base of the party, and therefore what their constituents are going to want them to do. And so they hear these Fox News hosts saying that the investigation is unjustified and illegitimate, and they follow along with that. And as they do that, it encourages Fox News to go even further along the same road. And so they sort of work themselves into a frenzy of sorts.
Kevin McCarthy, GOP leader, said that he tweeted to Attorney General Merrick Garland, "I've seen enough. The Department of Justice has reached an intolerable state of weaponized politicization. When Republicans take back the House, we will conduct immediate oversight of this department, follow the facts, and leave no stone unturned. Attorney General Garland, preserve your documents and clear your calendar." I mean, it sounds like a threat. It sounds like a political threat. And it really, we can trust Republicans to keep their promises like this, right? In the past, they've done so. They have had no problem using up the people's time to conduct baseless political hearings to their end. And it's likely if they do take back the House that they will do this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think Republican leaders don't want other Republican leaders to be subject to the rule of law. They think that the law is something that Democrats should have to follow, and they and the tax cheats who support them shouldn't have to you know, do that. It does sort of link up the way that they, in their rhetoric, they often connect the Trump investigation to the increased number of IRS agents in the Inflation Reduction Act, which will be signed into law this week. And what they say is that if they'll go after Trump, they'll also go after you and your taxes. They really want to protect tax cheats from having to deal with the additional IRS agents that the Democratic Party is getting hired.
Matt, where can people find out more about the work that you do with Media Matters?
At mediamatters.org, and follow me on Twitter at Matt Gertz.
And we'll post links to that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Matt Gertz, Senior Fellow at Media Matters for America, where he's been doing in-depth coverage of the right-wing focus on the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago and all of the wild conspiracy theories that have been woven out of it. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. During the 2020 mass racial justice uprisings, many Americans understood for the first time that racist police brutality was a critically important issue. While millions took to the streets of U.S. cities demanding change, some people engaged in purely symbolic gestures, such as posting black squares to their Instagram accounts. My next guest, W. Kamau Bell, together with his co-author Kate Schatz, has a new book for those who want to take action but don't know where to start. Do the Work, an anti-racist activity book, is an extensive primer into white supremacy in the United States, its history, its impact, and how people of color are leading the fight for racial justice. Chock full of questionnaires, coloring pages, crossword puzzles, and starting points for self-directed research, Do the Work has a foreword by Alicia Garza, founder of the Black Futures Lab. My guest is W. Kamau Bell. He is a well-known stand-up comedian, director, and executive producer of the four-part Showtime documentary We Need to Talk About Cosby, and host and executive producer of the Emmy Award-winning CNN docu-series United Shades of America with W. Kamau Bell. His new book, Do the Work, an anti-racist activity book, is co-written with Kate Schatz, and I spoke with him for Yes Magazine, where you can read the transcript of our conversation at yesmagazine.org. Welcome to the program, W. Kamau Bell.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get into why this book is needed in this time. When reading your activity book, it felt to me that the mass protests of 2020 has really opened the door for America as a whole to be much more receptive to a book such as this, a book such as this that, of course, could have been written many years ago, but it's more receptive now that we're in this moment now where white America might be more ready, perhaps, than before.
Yeah, I mean, I think through social media, it's a lot easier to see what everybody is doing and what everybody even thinks they're doing. So I think that in 2020, in the middle of COVID, and we're, and many of us are who can afford to be locked down or locked down in our houses, and there the news suddenly says, wait, COVID's important, but there's something else we need to talk about. And suddenly you see George Floyd being murdered on television by the Minneapolis police, and it leads to this so-called racial reckoning. And you know, a lot of people get on social media, and there's a lot of people on TV talking about what we can do now and how we can finally fix America's racism problem. And a lot of those people, you know, honestly, are white people who sort of are just realizing how deep and how long the problem has existed. I think a lot of these people are people who went to the kind of schools where you learn about racism through slavery and Martin Luther King Jr., and then everything is fine after that. So I think that, like, we saw a lot of people struggling with it, a lot of white people who wanted to help but really couldn't figure out what to do. We saw a lot of books go to the top of the New York Times bestseller list, a lot of great anti-racism books. But me and Kate, my co-author, were like, will these people know what to do after they read these books, and or will they even read these books? So it was really, our charge was to, like, how do we, as the saying goes, make the revolution irresistible? And so we just thought, try to make it more fun and surreptitiously revolutionary by turning it into activities and games.
Right. I mean, on the surface, it looks like a fun book. It's a huge topic. It's a deep and, you know, arguably the most important topic for America. And so choosing what to put in there and not to put in there, I imagine, must have been a huge task. You joke in the book that your editor wouldn't let you write a 10,000-page book. So how did you choose what goes in and what doesn't? And you open, I note, with an acknowledgement of how we do land acknowledgements for understanding whose indigenous lands we particularly live on. So that right there, if you can start with the decision to include that, and then how you made the decisions around what to include next.
Well, the thing that we sort of told ourselves, me and Kate, is that the book is wants to be funny, but it also wants to not be, and I'll say, messing around. We use more adult language than that. But so... That we wanted the book to, if you opened it and turned any page, even if it looked fun and funny, that there would be information or things that indicated, like, no, we're serious about this work. And so even before you get to the land acknowledgement, it starts with a poster that says end white supremacy that we challenge you to pull out and put someplace publicly in your life where other people will see it. For some people, that'll be easier. They'll put it next to the other end white supremacy poster. But for many people, the audience of this book, it's going to be a real challenge. And so, and then you get to the acknowledgement, and not that is a thing that we've talked about when we talk about indigenous issues in this country, but we also wanted to take it a step further and invite a Native American graphic designer, Sadie Redwing, to actually do some art in the book to talk about what this country would be like if we actually were aware and thought about the land we lived on more often. So we always were trying to push it one step further than what we thought was like the current version of the conversation. But yeah, I mean, honestly, you could do a whole book about this, about Native issues. And I hope that book comes. I hope there's a whole activity book about Native issues. And although me and Kate should definitely not write that book, it really was about, like, accepting at some point that the book was, it's 176 pages. I think it was supposed to be 150 pages, so we pushed it as far as we could. But really just sort of like understanding throughout the book, we're pushing people to do their own research. So I've seen people online do the land acknowledgement and then start to do a deep dive on their land acknowledgement and really find out things that we didn't assign them in the book, but we're really trying to make it again. Once you start going down that rabbit hole, we want you to keep going down that rabbit hole.
Is it a book for kids, adults, everyone in between? There is a little swearing, so it's a little edgy.
So it's up to how you raise your kids. I mean, I'll put it this way. My 11-year-old daughter has the book next to her bed, and she's working on it. Now, the fact she's my daughter may say she's a little more ready for this work, and also maybe she's heard me swear before. But it's not – I think a lot of people see this and want to think it's for kids because it seems like the kind of thing that kids – we want to think that kids need the anti-racism work, but really it's the adults that need it. So as parents, we put it in a format that we know is – that our kids like, which is games and activities, and certainly we live – as adults, we probably play more games now than we ever have in the history of the world through our phones and Wordle and Quirtle and Fortle and Adle. I don't know all the ones. So we are a gamified adult culture, but we wanted to do it in a way that was like through this book that sort of like disconnected your rational brain and sort of invited you to do some things. The way that you go to, as an adult, if you go to a dentist's office and there's a Highlights magazine, you pick it up because it's just like, I want to see what Goofus and Gallant are up to. Right. But it is, so I would say like definitely teenagers can do it. We actually are working on a book for younger readers that will be quite different, that is sort of in the same anti-racism vein, but it'll be quite different. It won't be a workbook because we want it to be able to go into libraries. But this is really for adults. It's really for adults.
White adults or all non-Black folks? You know, where do you draw the line? I mean, your co-author is white, and you do say in the book that it's for white folks.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think here's the thing. We understand this is about getting people to do the anti-racism work that they haven't probably been doing. So what does that mean? That means that, like, you know, the foreword is written by Alicia Garza. So that means we had to send it to Alicia Garza. She's one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter and leads the Black Futures Lab. So we wanted our activist friends to be able to read it and go, maybe this isn't all for me, but I see that you, what you're doing here, and I respect it. Or even somebody like Alicia Garza, there's probably something in the book that she's not aware of or something that she doesn't know all the way through. So, but it is really, it's a 101 book on racism, which means automatically the core audience is white people. But having said that, I put together the book. I didn't know all that stuff either. And I'm somebody who works in this anti-racism work every day. At least I try to. So I look at it this way. The TV show Friends was made for white people, but I enjoyed it. doesn't mean that I couldn't enjoy it. So this book, certainly the core audience may be white folks, but it doesn't mean that people who are not white can't pick something up. And also, I think white people tend to think that all of us non-white people know everything about every other culture. And so there is a mix of racial history and racial ideas in here that aren't just Black.
I mean, and as a non-Black person of color, I definitely felt like it was a book that I could work on and work through and felt like I could very much use. It's a book that's meant to be written in. You said it's a workbook. It's an activity book. Does that, just the mere fact of it being an activity book, you think, was that intended to give readers an ownership over anti-racism work?
It's meant to say that doing anti-racism work is actually a thing you do. It's not, you can read about it as a way to get prepared to do the work, but it actually is a thing you do, and it is often a tangible thing you do, and there's many ways to do it. So, you know, that it's if Martin Luther King had just written a story about a march to Washington, that would have been one thing, but it is not as powerful as an actual march on Washington. It's the same thing in the back of the book. We have a lot of stuff about fill out who your local politicians are, when your elections are. We have talked about registering to vote and things like that. So you can read about it, but if you don't actually do those things, it's not going to help you come voting season, which is what we're in right now. So it is an idea to sort of like, it is to get you to action. The book is designed to get you to action. It's like if you read a book about working out, you didn't actually work out, but the book about working out can help you learn how to work out better.
Tell me about how you approached the idea that white Americans are not always very receptive to facing their own privilege, facing their own culpability, whether or not they feel directly or indirectly responsible. There's a whole book written about white fragility. There's a lot of conversation around white folks accepting and understanding the role that they personally play, whether or not they are directly or they feel they're directly doing, you know, something that's racist or not. So how did you approach that?
I mean, I really do think that, like, for example, when we did, when 2020 happened, I got booked on a lot of late night talk shows hosted by white men. And there was a sort of a common refrain that's like, it's time we have the conversation. And I was like, no, we're way past the conversation. Mm. We have to stop thinking that the conversation is the work. So for me, it was like, we wanted the book, and Kate is a white woman, and we wanted the book to very quickly get you to doing the work. And I think a lot of times white people get caught up in like, oh my God, I didn't know this. And now they're stuck with all this knowledge they have about racism. And they're like, oh, I'm so overwhelmed by all the racism knowledge I have. I don't know what to do. And so we're like, being overwhelmed doesn't help create an anti-racist society in America. So it's fine if you have a moment of being overwhelmed, but we need to actually get you to actually doing the work to create less anti-racism. So we really understood, you know, the audience for this book was people who, like, I remember one day in 2020, a lot of people turned their Instagram squares to black, and it was supposed to be to promote anti-racism or racial justice. And I remember seeing a lot of people doing this, and nobody had sent that message to me, and I get sent a lot of those, we're gonna do this thing on this day for this reason. And so I reached out to Alicia Garza, actually, and I was like, what's happening? She's like, I have no idea. And then we both quickly realized that this was just this thing that had happened, and people thought that turning the Instagram squares to black was somehow doing something, and it wasn't connected to any action, any donation, any ask. It was just a symbol. And so this book is about, like, really those people who think that was doing the work going, no, that's not doing the work. This is doing the work. As my friend Jelani Cobb says, a lot of white people think doing the work is buying Juneteenth ice cream from Walmart, and that's not doing the work.
Now, one of the things that you take on in your book, among the many, many things, which I thought was fascinating, was talking about, well, what leads to a decision to call the police. We've, in the last few years especially, had, you know, with social media, with the ability of smartphones to capture footage, we've been able to see in real time what happens when white people in particular call the cops on black folks who are just existing, just living. And so tell me about that section in your book where you ask your readers to ask themselves questions before calling the cops.
You know, I think that this is about what your personal relationship is to the police. And I think for many white people in this country, their personal relationship to the police is that they are helpers, and they come when you call them, and they're never rude to you. They always trust what you say, and so you can trust them implicitly. And we wanted to be like, that's not true of everybody. And also, there's times when white people thought they were calling the police, and even saying explicitly to the dispatcher, this is a nonviolent person, they don't have a gun, please just come help them like you help me, and that person ends up dead. I can remember a situation, there was a young black man named Elijah McClain from Colorado. This is before 2020. He was just a young black man who apparently was dancing down the street, and all of Elijah's friends said he was quirky and sort of reveled in being a weirdo, and he was dancing down the street. This is the kind of, he apparently taught himself violin so he could play it for stray cats at like the ASPCA. He was that kind of dude. Sounds like a great dude. He was dancing down the street. Somebody called the cops because they said, I see this black man acting erratic. They said he's not doing anything violent, but he's dancing, but he's just acting erratic. I guess they thought they were helping him or worried about what he was going to do if he, and he was literally dancing down the street. The police showed up. They said he told them that he actually is like, I'm a strange person. Please forgive me. I'm not going to hurt anybody. They thought he was acting erratic. The EMTs came. They filled him up with sedatives, and he died in the hospital days later because they overdosed him on sedatives. And that was a black man who was walking down the street dancing. So we're trying to say, before you call the cops, really know why you're calling the cops, and also understand that the cops, you can't control what they do once they show up, especially if it's with a black person or a person of color.
Right. Your intention doesn't matter. The cop's intention matters, and that's something you can't control. And that to me was such a great sort of tangible thing that is a little tidbit for people to use and keep in their back pocket after they read their book that hopefully informs their decision if they're ever in that situation. What are you also...
I mean, this is true. I would just say this is also true of black people. This is also true of black people who call the cops because one of our loved ones is having a mental health challenge. Mm. And we call the cops saying, my loved one is having a mental health challenge. He needs help. And there's just 911 to call. So you call 911 and then they come and kill that person.
Yeah.
This has happened many times throughout this country in recent times.
Tell me about the ways in which you hope people will use the book to spark conversations. We don't like to talk about race in this country, especially white folks, to one another. Very much don't like to talk about race, or if there's mixed race families, you know, there's through marriage at the Thanksgiving family dinner, there's like one daughter-in-law or son-in-law of color, and having conversations about race can get awkward, especially all the assumptions that sometimes come
up. You're describing me and my in-laws.
So how does that you know, what advice do you give for folks about how important it is to talk about these issues?
Well, I mean, I think the idea being is that, do you want to be a good community member? And by community, there's a community of people who live in your house. There's the community is in your neighborhood, your city, and then there's your country. And so this is, racism is one of America's defining traits and one of its founding principles with the genocide of Native Americans and then also the enslavement of Africans. So until we actually really address that and really understand that, like, it didn't end when Lincoln freed the slaves, and it didn't end when indigenous people got given reservations. Until we understand that we still are suffering the effects of all that, we're really, I think this American experiment is basically doomed to fail. I didn't used to be this pessimistic about it, but having what I've seen the last couple of years, I really believe that. And so, you know, when you look at like the results of the election in Kansas, where they resoundingly said, no, we want to support a person's right to have an abortion. That is an idea of like, we need to draw some lines in the sand and we really need to be loud. We need to do the work. It's not just enough to say, to put your Instagram photo, a picture of, I support a person's right to have an abortion. I need to actually do the work. And so for me, if this leads people into actually like regular action, I always compare it to like in 2020, many people bought Pelotons and they got motivated by the fact that they were doing that every day and sharing it with their friends. I wish anti-racism work was that, could catch on like that and be that sort of like trendy, but I hope the trend actually stayed over time, unlike the Pelotons that are now like just expensive hangers.
In your chapter about, actually doing the work, what do I do? You have a whole interesting section on finding your lane and staying in your lane. Tell me what that means and how you hope that that's a clear-cut way for people to, or at least it's a way for people to be able to define what they can do and what role they can play.
Yeah, I mean, that was really, I wanted to give my co-author Kate credit there. That was really her like idea of like people say, because I think people often will say to a white person who's working it, who wants to be an anti-racist, stay in your lane, because they don't trust that white person to actually know what they're doing once they step out of their lane. And so we're saying, okay, if you are going to stay in your lane, you can do anti-racism work in your lane. You don't have to. I think a lot of times white people will get excited about being anti-racist and they'll go start a nonprofit that they have no business starting instead of going, no, what's your job now? Like, what's going on in your family? What's going on in your neighborhood now that you can actually work on? So we're actually asking people to like look at your lane, and we talk a lot about your work lane. Like, what is your work doing? And look around who you work with, how many people of color work there. What are you doing to make it easier on the Black folks and the people of color who work there? And what aren't you doing? How can you change it? So we use my career as an example of like my lane, because I think my lane is sort of ridiculous to go, I'm in showbiz, which is my lane. And who's in your lane? Well, it's Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Kevin Hart, and a bunch of white dudes named Chris, you know? So, but which is true, even though I'm not hanging out with those people, but that's true. And then it's like, well, what are the challenges? Well, the challenge is when I got to this career, I was regularly surrounded by white people who were apparently telling me how to be Black on television. And so over the last 10 years of my career, I have worked steadily to improve the diversity on my shows behind the camera, and I've worked steadily to promote diverse people to do jobs that they weren't going to have otherwise. So that's me looking at my lane. Now, showbiz seems like a ridiculous lane, but you can do that if you work at a fast food restaurant, or if you work at a school, or you work anywhere, or just a regular office. You can look at your lane and clean that lane up before you start going out into the world.
Finally, Kamau, you've got activities like literally like the kind you would find in an activity book, such as coloring pages and crossword puzzles. Tell me about that and why that was something that you decided, the coloring pages especially. Like, how do you learn to be an anti-racist by doing coloring?
Well, you know, we really want the book to be diverse. First of all, let's be clear, there's more than 15 artists in the book, and they're all artists of color, Black, Indigenous, and artists of color. So, and a lot of them who are being published for the first time, which is our way of doing the work. Our art designer is a Black woman named Diane Holton. So we were like doing the work while we were doing the work. And we wanted it to be a thing that if you flip through, maybe you're not into crossword puzzles, but you're into coloring pages. Maybe you're not into coloring pages, but you're into those activities where you try to find the hidden pictures. Maybe you're into a game. There's a little board game in the middle of the book. Maybe you're into the foldouts that have pictures of the Black women who are centering Black women's voices. Like, maybe that's, so we really wanted the art to be diverse in the way it looks and also who's making it. And also something that there's something in here you're going to stop on. And there's a lot of like adult coloring books, but what are you coloring? Rainbows? Birds? That's fine. But how about Nina Simone? How about James Baldwin? You know what I mean? So how about an Audre Lorde quote? Just the way to go. Again, it's not the work, but it does put, for some people, they're not going to know who those people are, or they don't really know what those people do. And it starts to get some curiosity going. But it wouldn't be enough to just do a whole book of anti-racism coloring pages, although who knows, maybe that'll happen too. It's just a way to sort of mix up the tones and textures of the book.
And also it brings joy, right? I mean, that's something we do need. Like, doing the work of anti-racism doesn't have to feel heavy, sad, painful. It can and should feel affirming and joyful, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a comedian, and yet this is my job. So I understand the fact that it's like the only thing that keeps you doing the work, and this is true of activists who aren't comedians, is humor and joy. Because you couldn't do the work if it was unrelentingly hard all the time. And there are times where it is unrelentingly hard. A lot of the Black women I know who work for reproductive rights services and organizations especially in the South, are having a hard time. And yet they still understand that sometimes they have to connect with joy.
I want to thank you so much, W. Kamau Bell, for joining us. Good luck to you and your co-author, Kate, with this book.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with W. Kamau Bell, a stand-up comedian, director, and executive producer of the four-part Showtime documentary We Need to Talk About Cosby, host and executive producer of the Emmy Award-winning CNN docuseries United Shades of America with W. Kamau Bell. And we've been talking about his new book, Do the Work, an anti-racist activity book, co-authored with Kate Schatz and a foreword by Alicia Garza. I interviewed Bell for Yes Magazine, and you can read the entire transcript of our conversation at yesmagazine.org, where I am the racial justice editor. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Nichelle Nichols, the pioneering Black actress who broke boundaries on screen with her role as Lieutenant Nyota Uhura on Star Trek, passed away on July 30th of this year. She was 89 years old. The actress was active both in front of the camera and behind the scenes, paving the way for people of color not only to access Hollywood roles, but also for Black and brown people to enter science fields. Political prisoner and award-winning journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal files this commentary for Prison Radio about Nichelle Nichols' legacy.
Nichelle Nichols, aiming for the stars. Almost 9 decades ago, a few years shy of a century, in fact, a Black girl was born in Robbins, Illinois, the year 1932. That girl was actor Nichelle Nichols, who blazed to television fame in the series Star Trek, which debuted in 1966. She played the role of Lieutenant Nyota Uhura, the communications officer for the Starship Enterprise. An actor, singer, and dancer, she was discovered by the legendary jazz and big band composer Duke Ellington. Her stunning beauty and dancer's carriage struck young boys and also inspired many young girls who aspired to a life on the stage. Although the original TV series only lasted until 1969, it sparked a franchise that continues to this day. As July marked its last Saturday, Nichelle Nichols left this life. Her son, Kyle Johnson, wrote the following message on her Facebook page. He wrote, "Last night, my mother, Nichelle Nichols, succumbed to natural causes and passed away. Her light, however, like the ancient galaxies now being seen for the first time, will remain for us and future generations to enjoy, learn from, and draw inspiration. Nichelle Nichols played several other roles in her long career. One that played on her science fiction role in Star Trek. She called for applications from women and people of color to join NASA, and thousands of applications poured in. Because of reruns, new generations saw and enjoyed her Star Trek performances. She lived to see 89 summers, as Lieutenant Uhura would have said. Hailing frequencies are now closed. For love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
You've been listening to a commentary by political prisoner and award-winning journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal about the pioneering black actress Nichelle Nichols. You can listen to all his commentaries online at prisonradio.org. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews and audio files on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.